It's Tuesday, December 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, challenges ahead for the president-elect as we look back at the U.S. presidential election.
They were particularly interested in the choice and had some strong opinions.
China wonders about how the incoming administration will affect relations. Also ahead, Japan's prime minister set to visit Pearl Harbor. Pacific Islands folklore inspires a new movie. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. When Time magazine chose President-elect Donald Trump as its Person of the Year for 2016, it came as no surprise after an election campaign that at times transfixed Americans and millions around the world. As we await Trump to take office, VOA national correspondent Jim Malone looks at how we got here and some of the challenges Trump will face as the incoming 45th president.
Donald Trump's journey to the White House began in June of 2015 with a campaign announcement befitting his reputation as a master showman and with a simple message that excited his supporters.
I am officially running for President of the United States, and we are going to make our country great again.
Wow. Trump was controversial from the start, promising a crackdown on illegal immigration and initially proposing a ban on Muslims wanting to come to the United States. Underestimated by his Republican rivals, Trump built his brand as a political outsider and swept through an experienced primary field that included feisty debate clashes like this one with former Florida Governor Jeb Bush.
This is a tough business to run for president.
Oh, no, you're a tough guy, Jeb.
And we need to have a leader that is
real tough.
You're never going to be president of the United States by insulting your way to the presidency.
Well, let's see, I'm at 42 and you're at 3, so far I'm doing better.
Doesn't matter.
In the race for the Democratic Party nomination, Hillary Clinton prevailed after a much tougher than expected primary challenge from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Once she secured the nomination, Clinton sought to cast Trump as unfit to be president.
A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons.
But on election night, Trump stunned the world with a victory few had predicted over the heavily favored Clinton. In his victory speech, Trump sounded a conciliatory tone after a divisive campaign.
To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
Clinton also urged her supporters to respect the outcome.
Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead.
One of the keys to Trump's victory was a desire for change, says analyst Tom DeFrank.
I think we all, including the media, but everybody, misunderestimated, as George W. Bush might say, the profound desire for change. And in the end, Trump, with all his imperfections, with all his blemishes, was the only perceived agent of change.
Trump will take office with the advantage of Republican control of Congress, says John Fortier.
And I think that allows him to have an agenda that goes forward on domestic policy and legislation, where a Hillary Clinton would have had a harder time with divided government doing those things.
Trump must now balance a desire to deliver on promises to his core supporters while at the same time trying to bring the country together after one of the most divisive elections in U.S. history. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
There's plenty on our website at voanews.com. It's time for us to look at social media with my colleague, Michael Lippin. Michael, why is the phrase white genocide getting so much attention on Twitter today in the United States?
It's an odd phrase, but yes, Jim, that's because an American professor of politics at a university in the city of Philadelphia tweeted about that phrase, white genocide, on Monday night. And his tweet set off a wave of social media criticism, as well as a backlash to the criticism from the professor and his supporters. So let me explain first what this term means. White genocide is an expression used by white supremacists here in the U.S. and elsewhere who believe that there are forces at work in predominantly white countries, seeking to turn them into minority white countries, or even to make white people go extinct through mass immigration, integration, and assimilation. Now, the professor in question is George Cicciariello Mayer of Drexel University. He's a liberal and a white political commentator who has 10,000 Twitter followers, and on Sunday night, he posted them a tweet saying, "All I want for Christmas is white genocide." That's a play on a popular Christmas song. Now, his Twitter account setting was set to protected when reporters checked it early Monday, which means that anything he tweets cannot be seen by all Twitter users, only his followers. But it appears that the white genocide tweet was posted by someone as a screenshot and then shared widely by conservative Twitter users who were in uproar about it. Here's a comment from one of them by the name of Casey Dillon. A professor at Drexel University tweeted, "All I want for Christmas is white genocide. What a ridiculous thing for an quote-unquote educator to say." And here's another by an account that says it represents Republicans in Tennessee. "Professor at Drexel University says, 'All I want for Christmas is white genocide.' Where's liberal outrage over racism here?"
Well, how have the professor and his supporters been responding?
Well, the professor told several news outlets today that he was mocking what he called the imaginary concept of white genocide, and that his critics have misunderstood what was meant to be a satirical tweet. Cicciariello Mayer's employer wasn't convinced. Drexel said it recognizes the right of its faculty to freely express thoughts and opinions in public debate, but it also said Cicciariello Mayer's comments were utterly reprehensible, deeply disturbing, and do not in any way reflect the values of the university. It also summoned him to a meeting to explain himself. But in his defense, an American University of Beirut professor, Stephen Ciliata, tweeted this: "Drexel University should firmly support George Cicciariello Mayer's speech rights instead of humoring an online mob that misunderstands his tweet." Jim?
No shortage of controversy on Twitter. Thank you for the analysis, Michael. You can follow him at Michael_Lippin. I'm out there at VOA Stevenson, and follow our International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia: friend of impeached South Korean president apologizes for scandal. Thai police charge man in hacking attacks on government sites. Civilians helping governments stake claims in South China Sea. Philippines typhoon kills at least four, causes flooding and damage. Chinese aircraft carrier enters the South China Sea amid renewed tensions. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website. And take the news with you. If you have a smartphone, be sure to use our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. President-elect Donald Trump's nomination of ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson to be Secretary of State is raising some eyebrows in Beijing. As the head of the U.S. energy giant, Tillerson has developed warmer ties to Russia's rulers and oil companies as opposed to those in China. And that's led some observers in China to express concern that Tillerson's mission as chief U.S. diplomat might be to flip Russia from being an ally of Beijing to being an ally of Washington. In our latest VOA China 360 podcast, my colleague Michael Lippin explores Tillerson's nomination with Andy Serwer. He's the chief editor of the Yahoo Finance news site. Serwer says that he had several concerns about Tillerson when he met with Chinese business figures in Beijing earlier this month.
When Rex Tillerson was announced as Trump's choice as Secretary of State, I happened to be with a number of Chinese oil executives. And, of course, they were particularly interested in the choice and had some strong opinions. First of all, they had a couple of them had questions that anyone might have, which is this guy qualified? He, you know, represented Exxon, certainly has global experience, but as a representative, as the chief executive of Exxon, and that doesn't match being the Secretary of State of the United States. And then the second thing, though, was that they noted, and they knew right away about his close ties to Russia and to Putin. And they suggested that, this was something that would be, seen as a sign to China.
Tillerson has had some business dealings with China as well, visiting the country on behalf of Exxon several times since 2008. Serwer says those visits did not make much of an impression on his Chinese contacts.
They didn't have any personal interactions with Tillerson, but they did note the fact that China has long had Exxon's presence in the country. And, you know, Exxon started selling kerosene there 100 years ago. And it now has a fairly significant operation there. And, you know, they sort of said, well, you know, if Rex Tillerson's going to be all buddy-buddy, you know, with Russia, then, you know, the Chinese government no doubt will take note vis-a-vis Exxon's presence in China. And, you know, I said, well, at that point, he would no longer be the chief executive of Exxon. And they sort of said, well, that doesn't matter.
The comment raises the question that Chinese authorities could take note by retaliating against Exxon for any attempt by a Secretary of State Tillerson to push Moscow away from Beijing. Serwer says that possibility occurred to him after chatting with the executives.
That's a very speculative point, and a lot of conjecture there, a lot of if-thens. And you know, none of these people, you know, spoke for the highest authorities in China or President Xi, for that matter. But, you know, that seemed to be the thinking. And, you know, of course, we've already seen, you know, what sort of might amount to that in the auto industry, where the Chinese government announced that it was taking action against U.S. automakers. And some people have speculated that that is in retaliation for some of Trump's statements and the phone call with the president of Taiwan. And, of course, the Chinese government denied it. And, you know, if there was ever something, an action taken against Exxon, you know, the Chinese government might deny that it had anything to do with Rex Tillerson. And, you know, we'd actually have no way of knowing. So there's a lot of opaqueness, potentially. And, you know, it's very hard to know how things might pan out. I mean, it might be the case that Rex Tillerson would make a deal with the Chinese and the Russians together when it comes to oil and gas. Or he may not have anything to do with oil and gas at all. And you know, as Secretary of State, he should probably seek to, you know, do more with regard to nation building and relations between countries than business.
As head of Exxon, Tillerson has made other deals that have drawn concern from China. Among them are an Exxon agreement with Vietnam to drill for natural gas in the South China Sea waters, most of which are claimed by Beijing. You'll find more with Yahoo Finance Chief Editor Andy Serwer on Michael Lippin's VOA China 360 podcast, on his Facebook journalist page, and also on iTunes. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has arrived in Hawaii to visit the Pearl Harbor Memorial, symbol of the Japanese surprise attack in December 1941 that thrust the United States into World War II. The visit follows President Barack Obama's unprecedented trip to Hiroshima, Japan, in May. That was the site of the U.S. atomic bombing in August 1945, near the end of the war, where he urged the world to do away with nuclear weapons. The chief mission of the Abe visit will be to underscore the bilateral security alliance and pay homage to the victims of Japan's attack, in which about 2,400 Americans died. The meeting also comes just weeks before the inauguration of Donald Trump, who has questioned the presence of American troops in Japan and plans to scrap U.S. participation in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Pact. Security analyst Yoichiro Sato of Japan's Ritsumeikan Asia-Pacific University was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty why Mr. Abe doesn't wait until after Trump's inauguration.
I think it's more symbolic that Abe is reciprocating Obama's visit to Hiroshima. If Abe goes, you know, after Trump becomes the president, then, you know, this reciprocation aspect gets a little bit fuzzy. And it's very important that Japan is trying to send a message, not only to the United States about the solidarity of the alliance partnership, but also to Japan's immediate neighbors, which have complaints about Japan over the historical issues. And by showing that Japan and the United States can overcome the historical past and move forward, then Japan can try to neutralize the history-based diplomatic offensive by China and Korea.
But there won't be any apology.
I do not think that the statement will be of apologetic nature, but more of recognizing, the mutually recognizing the unfortunate past and the process which led to the eventual conflict, and then building on the post-World War II cooperation, the two countries will further enhance their partnership. I think that's going to be the core of the message.
Now, this comes just days after the U.S. and Japan held a ceremony last Wednesday marking the U.S. military's return of nearly 4,000 hectares, about 10,000 acres of land on Okinawa, to Japan, the largest transfer since 1972. How significant is that?
I think it's very significant, although the opposition groups in Okinawa don't seem to be satisfied. But prior to the final settlement of the Futenma relocation, which became much more symbolic in this relationship, the most recent land transfer is more of a tangible aspect of the base rationalization efforts in Okinawa. And I'm sure there will be a lot of benefit to Okinawa as well.
There is strong opposition to U.S. bases on Okinawa because of noise, pollution, and incidents of crime. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Disney's latest animated movie, Moana, is riding a wave of popularity around the globe. It's inspired by the folklore of the Pacific Islands. Scholars say for centuries, some of the ancient world's greatest navigators discovered and settled the many islands of Oceania. But about 3,000 years ago, those voyages stopped for about 1,000 years, and no one knows why. That's where Moana, which means ocean in many Polynesian languages, begins, as Heidi Chang reports.
The film tells the story of Moana, a young girl growing up on a fictional island in the Pacific. She's drawn to the sea, but her father forbids her from sailing beyond the reef. However, when their food supply begins to dwindle and fish start dying, Moana sets sail into the open ocean to save her people by finding a demigod named Maui. Native Hawaiian teenager Ali'i Carvalho is the voice of the Polynesian heroine.
Maui? Shapeshifter? Demigod of the wind and sea? I am Moana.
Hero of men.
What?
It's actually Maui, shapeshifter, demigod of the wind and sea, hero of men. I interrupted from the top. Hero of men. Go.
Maui, voiced by Dwayne Johnson, who's part Samoan, guides Moana in her quest to become a wayfinder, navigating only by the signs of nature. In doing so, she discovers her identity.
Teach me to sail. My job is to deliver Maui across the great ocean. I should be sailing.
It's called wayfinding, princess. And it's not just sails and knots. It's seeing where you're going in your mind. Knowing where you are by knowing where you've been.
Screenwriter Aaron Kendall grew up in Hawaii and drew on his wayfinding training with master navigator Nainoa Thompson to accurately portray the traditional skill. He says the lessons he learned from Thompson continue to guide him.
What Nainoa said is whatever you want to achieve, whether it's literally sailing to an island as Moana does in the movie, or if it's, you know, getting your dream job or any goal that you have in life, you can reach it no matter how impossible or far away it seems if you hold the island in your heart and in your mind.
That connection with ancestral knowledge in the movie appeals to Manolani Aluli Meyer, Director of Indigenous Education at the University of Hawaii, West Oahu. She was especially moved by a scene in which Moana's grandmother encourages her to discover the wisdom of her ancestors.
When the kupuna said, go into this blocked off cave and see who you are, and then and you just saw the canoes, I cried at that because we are wayfinders. We go where nobody else has gone. We have sailed the open ocean when Europeans thought it ended. And I love the idea that we are wayfinding again. And that is pivotal for our people, for my people in Hawaii, that we are finding ourselves by going outward to find our inward strength.
Kandel's twin brother, Jordan, was also part of the screenwriting team and says even though it's set in a remote part of Oceania eons ago, Moana's story is a universal one.
As an American in a world in which we've had a first female try to break the glass ceiling in the highest office of our land, to tell a story for girls, for my own four-year-old daughter, for women everywhere, that whatever you believe in, whatever you want, you can achieve. I think that message for today's world only continues to be incredibly important. And I think that's what makes it timely.
That message resonates with filmgoers like 16-year-old Lauren Trujillo, who has a personal connection to Moana.
I loved it so much. Seeing my best friend, Ali Carvalho, be the voice of Moana, it was just really emotional for me, and I'm so proud of her and everything she's accomplished. I feel very empowered after watching it. I feel like I can do anything now.
For VOA News, I'm Heidi Chang in Honolulu.
We thank you so much for joining us today for International Edition. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Dave Magnus. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. Thanks so much and have a great day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan David Hale, along with National Highway Authority Chairman Shahid Ashraf Tarar and Frontier Works Organization Director Major General Mohammed Afzal, opened an exhibition displaying photos of the recently rehabilitated section of National Highway 25 connecting Shaman to Kalat through Quetta, Baluchistan. The United States, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, funded the construction of the 111 kilometers needed to complete National Highway 25 in cooperation with the Frontier Works Organization, the prime contractor, and the National Highway Authority. USAID provided $63 million to rehabilitate the highway and has committed an additional $27 million for further improvements. The newly restored highway will increase trade and economic integration by linking Pakistan with Afghanistan and its Central Asian neighbors. The road, which stretches from Shaman on the border with Afghanistan to Karachi, will also improve the lives of the people of Baluchistan by expanding access to basic health care, education, and other social services. The Frontier Works Organization began construction in October 2014. This road is a concrete demonstration of America's commitment to help bring peace, stability, and prosperity to Pakistan. It is a testament to the far-reaching benefits of our partnership, as it will serve the people of Pakistan for generations to come, Ambassador Hale said at the inauguration. The funding for this highway is one element of USAID's $681.5 million FATA infrastructure program, which has restored essential public infrastructure in remote communities. To date, the United States has funded the construction and rehabilitation of more than 2,200 kilometers of roads in Pakistan, including the four major trade routes between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Pakistan, to help build the infrastructure that will enhance trade and better the lives of the people of Pakistan and the Central Asian region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.